So welcome to our panel on radical housing. I'm Julia Vitullo-Martin, the director of the Center for Urban Innovation at the Regional Plan Association. And we have, obviously, a very distinguished panel. I'll give extremely brief introductions to each one as we go along. It's going to be just the way they're sitting, Geralyn, Mike, Roseanne, Jonathan. So Geralyn Perrine, former New York City Housing Commissioner, is going to set the stage for us. Geralyn has 30 years of experience in housing and planning. She is now Executive Director of the Citizens Housing and Planning Council. I personally, I think probably more than anybody else in this room, know deeply how intelligent, creative, and strong-willed Geralyn is, because I used to have that job. The truth is that Geralyn does it far better than I ever did it. I sort of feel like I need to say, you're a better man than me, Gunga Dean. So please join me in welcoming Geralyn Perrine.
Thank you.
Perrine.
Thank you. Whatever. I could do it from here. Well, so, of course, I have to advance the slides first, right? So I will have all the technical problems in the show if they are going to exist, right? Oh, okay. So I thought, well, all right, radical housing. So I actually looked up the word radical. And here's the definition in at least the little dictionary that I have. Of or going to the root or origin of, far-reaching, thorough, advocating thorough reform. So I'm actually going to start with the middle, which is far-reaching, thorough. So what's our thinking right now? What are our goals for housing? Well, right out of Plan YC 2030, this is what the stated goal for housing is. Create homes for almost a million more New Yorkers, more than today, while making housing more affordable and sustainable. Okay, that's a pretty radical goal. So I thought the first thing we should think about is, I think we would all agree with this goal, or most of us would, and it's great. So how well are we really doing it, and what is actually sort of the root of our thinking about this problem? So how do people live now, before the million people come? And then that, I think, helps us think about how they might live into the year 2030. So if we're going to think about our housing situation now and how it's going, normally this is going to conjure up an image of construction in your brains, and we'll talk about that a little, but I'd also like you to think about this. It is not so much about the ceiling, how much more we can build, how much bigger we can make it. It's really going to be about the floor. What is the base standard and system of habitability that we're going to accept people living in? Because as you'll see, right now, we already have a housing problem, and more people are falling further towards the floor than they are heading to the ceiling. So the first thing is, let's think about who we think we are. Well, this is kind of who we still think we are. So housing policy is still, I think, a little bit stuck in 1959. The big notable, I think, change would be probably not so much the mom blowing smoke in her kid's face, and maybe not so much the creepy dad with the daughter on his lap. But other than that, this is who we think we are in housing policy. So because this is who we think we are, this is what we think everyone wants. A three-bedroom with a living room, dining room, you know, the master bedroom near the kids' bedroom so that when the kids cry at night or need a glass of water, the mom can jump up and, you know, get them their water. And, you know, two bathrooms, you know, very nice. So this is kind of where we are. We want, you know, Ozzie and Harriet, and this is what we keep building. But it's not exactly who we are. So we're actually in New York. One out of four New Yorkers are born in a foreign country. An incredibly diverse tableau of people from all over the world, coming with a variety of skill sets. And only 34% of us are white and non-Hispanic, like I am.
And that foreign-born population is growing. Our white and African-American population is both shrinking and aging. And overall, our population is aging. So by 2030, our elderly population will increase by a full 44%. And for the Ozzie and Harriet lovers, actually only 17% of our households live in a housing unit as a nuclear family alone. 17%. 33% of our housing stock is occupied by a single person living alone. Granted, some of these people are lying and actually have roommates that they're hiding from their landlord, but that's the number that is reported. A third of our housing stock occupied by single people living by themselves. 20% of our households live with some kind of related situation, some kind of shared situation, related adults and family sharing. A full 850,000 units in our city today are occupied by some kind of shared households, either with relatives who are sharing with them or non-relatives sharing with them. That is a very, very big number. This is not addressing any issues of homelessness, poverty, nothing like that. This is just how people today are fitting themselves, how our 8.2 million people are fitting themselves into our existing housing stock. And sharing is becoming, obviously, more and more common. But, you know, we feel very differently about different kinds of sharing. We love this. Everybody wants this. I mean, everybody would like to be, you know, I guess 25 and, be nice, living in a loft with your friends. It's great. However, this is not accessible to everyone. And this is illegal, right? I mean, this started not only as an illegal occupancy of a type of building that was not legal for residential use. It's also illegal to live with four or more single adults that are unrelated. Yet our sense of things, our public policy response to this kind of a population, going back to the early Soho pioneers, was we just love them all so much. You know, we changed our whole government policy and turned it into a pretzel. We created special laws to both protect the tenants from eviction and extreme rent increases, and to also give the landlords a path to legalizing their buildings to at least create a fire-safe environment. We gave them time and often money to do that. We feel differently about different kinds of sharing. We don't feel that way about this kind of sharing. And a lot of people in our city are living like this now. This is an illegal boarding house. This is a couple living in a shared situation in a very small apartment. We are not turning ourselves into a pretzel to either ensure that there is fire safety brought to this situation to protect these people from eviction or, you know, extreme rent increases or all the other things that can happen to them. And overall, we just react to this type of sharing with a kind of, this is bad, off with their heads, it's dangerous, and it is. We're seeing more and more fires where people actually die because they are living in these kinds of situations, or firemen are going into buildings that they can't know in advance that has been heavily partitioned. So for these landlords, even the best of them don't really have a path to legalization. And even as we speak right now, there's a text change going through the zoning resolution, which will essentially close the door on the legal conversion of small homes, further pushing those illegal occupancies in attics and basements further and further underground. So what are we doing? Well, we're rezoning our old industrial areas. This is good. This creates land for new development, and we think it's a good thing. However, we seem to get mad about this too. This is the Williamsburg waterfront, which, you know, people just seem to be all excised about now that we're doing that. It's the right thing to do. And density, right? This is what our city's about. This is like the icon of who we are and what we are, and yet we seem to hate it, really. We've got this sort of love-hate thing with density, so we don't really actually want it. Now, partly I think we don't want it because we just do density and there's no actual planning, so we don't deal with schools. Plan NYC, by the way, predicting 1 million more people, actually also says there's no need for new schools. It's not going to increase any need for schools. We don't really deal with cars because we think everybody's going to start riding a bike from Floral Park into Midtown. And we don't really seem to be able to expand our mass transit very well because we don't, as a city, actually control it. So a recent study by Furman Center said that of all the rezonings, only 14% of the lots rezoned actually resulted in an increase in density, which would actually increase our capacity for residential by 1.7%. So we don't really think that's going to work, and we're not really doing, I think, that well with sustainability either, unless we can really subsidize it, which we can't do for everywhere. So what should we do to advocate for thorough reform? I think we should eradicate the notion of family from housing units. I think we should make minimum space standards more flexible, make room sizes and uses more flexible. Sharing is here to stay. We should figure out how to make it work. We should really increase density and not just talk about it. We should eradicate the disincentives to using green technologies, which still really permeate many and many of our rules. And so with that, I will turn it over back to Julia.
Well done, Geraldine. So Geraldine really took seriously the title, Radical Housing. So thank you. Eradicate the notion of family. Right. Our next speaker, Mike Kelly, holds a BA in Architecture and Urban Planning from Princeton. Mike is a general manager of the New York City Housing Authority and has worked for the San Francisco Housing Authority, the Washington, D.C. Housing Authority, and the New Orleans Housing Authority, every one of which at one time or another was regarded as one of the most troubled large housing authorities in the country. And all three of them to this day still have very troubled projects. So Mike's in a very different position today as general manager of NYCHA, which probably still retains the rank of the most respected large housing authority in the country. So let's welcome Mike Kelly.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Radical. Selinsky, let's see. Agitate, educate, organize. Fidel Castro, don't leave property to anybody but the state. As a basis, that'll weave through my presentation here. I'm actually going to share with you, believe it or not, that other people around the country are doing things besides what people do in New York City. So I will now share with you some of public housing responses to neighborhood distress through major neighborhood revitalization. And so I guess the real thematic of this brief presentation is social justice affordable housing. So we're looking at neighborhood revitalization with a different set of metrics. That we're now looking at economic integration, but that economic integration isn't necessarily moving higher income folks into neighborhoods, but looking at those elements that make a healthy neighborhood, be it open space, a school, a shopping center, a place where you can pick up your dry cleaning or pick up a sandwich or a cup of coffee, and ensuring that these types of neighborhood amenities, based on a good school, by the way, are available for low-income people as well as high-income people. Looking at mixed income and not mixed aesthetic, so being committed to an architectural design and an architectural material standard that is market rate, irrespective of who lives within the site or within the building. So at the end of the day, you have your school teacher, your welfare recipient, and your lawyer living next to each other. And from the outside, you can't tell who's who because we're looking at subsidizing units, not necessarily subsidizing or creating differentiation between the kinds of building types, the type of unit amenities from one site to another. Looking at developing with human infrastructure concurrent with physical infrastructure, so it's physical and social, that as we prepare pro formas that we include in the bottom line as it relates to sources, dollars that are available for case management, particularly around relocation, or dollars available for community empowerment or family self-sufficiency. And so we do not go to the closing table until those dollars are identified and that programming is embedded with the same kind of milestone expectations that you would have around the completion of demolition or the completion of construction or marketing, et cetera. Capitalizing on market, real estate, and financing, recognizing, as Fidel does, that the dirt has value and that it's okay to have private sector partner with you in improving the quality of the neighborhood through major revitalization efforts, of which housing is a basis. But that the property itself doesn't leave the ownership of the state, that you can have longer-term ground rights, air rights, established kinds of systems, that there is a reversion that goes back to the people at the end of the financial life of the particular deal. And that, again, just to take it to one, to a very specific example, downtown Havana right now going through major historical renovation, of which the Cuban people do not have money to pay for, looking at international dollars in which the individual properties are made available to private sector investors with the understanding that the first floor is maintained in some fashion that fits the neighborhood or fits the planner's recognition of what best serves that neighborhood, be it a flower shop or a bookstore, et cetera, and that the second and third floors are now available for the private sector to do what they need to do as part of their investment. So there is an opportunity to have private sector dollars be embedded in the financing of the deal that benefits the neighborhood or benefits the quality of life. And finally, and as importantly, a coordination at the stakeholder scale, be it the residents that live in the site, the neighbors around the residents, the city, as a whole, the region as a whole, and as the nation as a whole, and that we're looking at having a set of standards and a set of expectations that are really built around sustainability. And not only talking about sustainability in the narrow sense of make it green, but sustainability in the sense of how do you make it healthy for long term, for generations to come. So I'm going to walk you through very briefly sort of a case study here of Washington, D.C. Yeah, this is East Capitol Dwellings. It's the easternmost point of the district. It's a point that when I got there in 2000, it was a barrack-style public housing. A lot of vacancies as a kind of indicator of distress. This vacancy is translated into high crime. No public amenities or services, lousy schools, no place to shop, etc. Substandard design, substandard architectural, so that there was architecturally obsolete almost at the date that they completed building it. Going through the proverbial design charrette, again looking at having design professionals work in a coordinated fashion with the city, with the housing authority, with the residents, with the neighbors, with the developers, to work out a visioning exercise. That visioning exercise includes empowering leadership at every level, so we're not just talking about the electeds being the leaders, but leadership in the form of the resident that will live in, that's currently living at the site, will have to go through relocation and empower to come back, what their feelings are about this, the guy or gal that runs the bodega across the street, what are their feelings about this, the city planners, etc. So it's leadership at every level. Developing the actual larger plan, looking at the marketing, the construction, and actually getting the completed neighborhood built with the idea, again, that this is a mixed income, mixed financed, mixed use, mixed tenure, meaning homeownership as well as a rental. So we're now looking at, and also mixed building sizes, and making sure that the architecture either is consistent with the neighborhood fabric for blending in, or in a situation where the entire looks like freestanding army barracks, is that you create a fresh vernacular by establishing a kind of model that anything that follows you will now have this new look to it. So this is the programming that occurred from that particular project. It was a transit-oriented development project close to the metro stop. So we're really looking. It was really looking at converting a distressed public housing site into a thriving new neighborhood that included a facility for seniors, a new shopping center, some small retail, and housing for various income levels. And the housing, it's again, is indistinguishable based on what it looks like from the outside. The income levels was what they were, but the outside was all built to market. And this slide is just to show, you know, the complexities of getting stuff done in the public sector, the alphabet soup of the sources, HOPE 6, CDBG, low-income housing tax credits, CIP. These are all things that recognize that it isn't a silver bullet to getting these projects done, that that there needs to be a coordinated effort to bring in as many different local, state, and federal governmental resources, but as importantly, to make sure that the private equity that goes into these deals is done in a way that, that is done fairly, that the government isn't the first money in, it's the government isn't the one doing all the risk, that it's shared risk, shared profit. But the fundamental premise that we want everybody to succeed, that you must have the market rate people and the market rate partners be successful, because the higher their profit, the more money is available to cover the cost of constructing the low and the moderate income housing, and the more money available to deal with the net operating income long term. So in San Francisco, as a quick spin around the country here, my first stop, I wasn't around for the finalizing of this, but I was around for the visioning exercise of it. Around the Fisherman Wharf area, there was public housing around the cable car turnaround. So incredible location. However, you know, tourists were consistently being harassed, and it was a whole tension between an indigenous population that was now being threatened on an hourly basis by people with cameras and stuff, and vice versa. And so, what do you do about it? Well, you replace poured-in-place concrete, very public housing-looking stuff with an integrated housing and retail solution. New Orleans, St. Thomas, again, a distressed public housing, looking at replacing it with the kind of housing that fits with the nature of the Garden District. And again, it's mixed, these various funding sources. In Washington, D.C., the Capra Carlsberg, this is a property that the Housing Authority was working closely with the Planning Department around the Anacostia Waterfront Initiative. We were the first boots on the ground in terms of neighborhood revitalization. Today, that neighborhood includes a baseball stadium for the lousiest baseball team in the country, as well as a Michael Graves transportation building and larger housing. This was, and that the public housing, I believe, was the generator of this larger economic revitalization. In New York City, again, just for as much for illustrative purposes, looking at working with the Harlem Children's Zone. This is in a proposal stage right now, but I show this slide to show that the challenges that we have here in New York are in many ways different. The preservation issues and the preservation commitment are different. The level of distress is different here than it is and across the country in many areas. And so how do you deal with the issue? It's obviously, making sure that the brickwork is good, the elevators work, the elevators, and that the roofing is tight, making sure that the services are there. But when you're looking at development, infill becomes the model. So in this particular instance, a charter school along with potential housing, the idea of cutting a fresh street through the currently cul-de-sac center of the site to reintegrate the neighborhood grid. And conceptually, you're now looking at this fresh street as an opportunity to have retail on the first floor on either side of this freshly cut street and additional housing or other community resources above this first floor endeavor. So the idea of infill to increase density to allow for additional mixed income, mixed market kind of housing, at the same time breaking up the stigma of public housing, hopefully here in New York forever. So that concludes it. Thank you very much.
Wow. Thank you, Mike. So, is it fair to say, Mike, or is it an exaggeration to say that in the St. Nicholas project, the idea of integrated housing and retail has finally come to New York?
Well, actually, it's fair to say. I think there are projects that are currently.
I think, aren't there 32 buildings out of?
Well, again, it's the, I think
right,
it's
with retail and yeah, I mean, it's minimal. Right?
Yeah, well, again, we could talk about it more, but yeah. But I think that there's great opportunity here for us to continue to look at the value of the parks in the Tower of the Park as an economic driver to preserve public housing as well as bring in much needed neighborhood amenities within the public housing sites.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Our third speaker is Roseanne Haggerty. Roseanne is the president of Common Ground, a New York-based nonprofit organization dedicated to finding innovative solutions to homelessness. Roseanne and I met, I think, 3 years ago. An editor of mine kept sending me these annoying emails saying that I really needed to call up Roseanne Haggerty and go look at her projects, and that if I did go look at Roseanne's projects, I would actually write about some of the housing issues facing street people and homeless families differently. So eventually I did call up Roseanne, and she showed me around her Midtown projects, and indeed my editor was right. Roseanne's work is so astonishingly impressive and also of great staying power that it really, Roseanne's work totally changed my view of what could be done with street homelessness. So please join me in welcoming Roseanne Haggerty.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here. I guess my take on the question radical housing is the question of how do we house everyone? And I think what's at stake for communities like ours, communities around the country where homelessness is an issue, is that we have a public health emergency that faces individuals and families who have lost their housing or are living in precarious housing. And it's a public cost emergency for the rest of us because we deal with this issue one way or another. We're paying for the stress of homelessness and the experience of homelessness in hospitals, jails, shelters, and there's a lot better things we can be doing. And in fact, what our work has been about largely has been not just looking at new forms and economic and social arrangements in housing to create opportunities for everyone to have a stable place to live, but I think more and more I'm realizing it's about recovering old ideas and refreshing them and reintroducing them. And I'd like to start, I'm going to highlight two of our projects and start with our Andrews House. The Andrews House is located on the Bowery, and it's an old lodging house that we've reimagined, reconditioned, and reopened as of last summer. And it began, really, I think, importantly, as a process story. We started about 10 years ago with my colleagues simply asking homeless people living on the streets around Times Square, what would it take to get you a place to live, and what aren't we doing as housers? And we actually had pretty amazing responses. We interviewed 127 people, first just in the Times Square area, then around the city, and found amazing consistency to people's responses, that people actually had a little money, and they were very prepared to pay for housing, but they didn't have anything at their price point. They were looking for something modest, safe, clean, and anonymous. They were very, kind of impressively respectful to us social worker types who are inquiring of their preferences, but they actually wanted to be able to live in a place where they didn't have to pour out all of their personal information. So we went back after consolidating all this information and realizing that this was, in one respect, an unserved market, and began a whole series of design charrettes with individuals we invited into one of our buildings and started, with paper and then all, building some prototypes, create some ideas in response to the consistency of this desire. And kind of surprisingly, perhaps to us, but in some ways very obviously, what people described was something like a clean, well-run lodging house, a form of housing that existed historically in every American city. And in fact, there we go. In fact, and here's the Andrews House, the tallest building in that picture, built in 1901. When we purchased it 6 years ago, it was one of the few remaining lodging houses on the Bowery, which up until about the 1950s had over 100 of these buildings and over 3,000 very modest, small, not necessarily so safe, clean, but certainly anonymous and inexpensive places for people to live. And the aha moment for us came with the realization that if you eliminate a form of housing and don't replace it, of course you get homelessness. And so we bought the Andrews, and we there it is in the middle now. The neighborhood has changed around us. We now have on either side luxury housing. In the middle there, we've added three stories to the building, and where we used to have 200 very tiny cubicles, we now have 146 units that you see on the right there in a really elegantly designed arrangement. We had a design competition to really put it to the design and architectural community how we could wrestle with this question of how do we create a decent, livable, comfortable environment with very little space. And so we have these 90-square-foot units, 146 of them, that are remarkably popular. And so I'm going to talk about the Skirmerhorn house project next. But before leaving the Andrews, I just want to point out as well that it's not unrelated that we have seen a remarkable decline in homelessness throughout the city, even though this year the numbers tick back up over the last few years as we've, as a community, focused very, very strongly on housing people in the most vulnerable health directly from the street. We've seen about a 30% decrease in homelessness, and many of the men living here at the Andrews are the people that you used to pass on city streets, and people are well on their way to permanent housing. We use this as a transitional environment and get people off the street and then work with them intensively to find permanent housing like Skirmerhorn House. So we're moving from new/old forms to new/old economic and social arrangements. And as Michael pointed out, the idea of in New York, someone who is living on a very modest income, living next to someone who has a very different income, is as old as the hills. That's what New York is about, the density and diversity of our city. And so Skirmerhorn House kind of has recreated this in a very interesting way. It's in downtown Brooklyn. It's a site that was for about 40 years vacant in a parking lot. It was an urban renewal site that about 7 years ago was RFP'd by the state. And a team of Hamlin Ventures and Time Equities acquired the site, and with it an affordability requirement left over from the urban renewal restrictions. They came to us and asked us if we would team up with them and develop the site as a new urban neighborhood. Their plan for the State Street side of the site was luxury townhomes, and yet they offered us an opportunity to build 217 units right next to the luxury townhomes for some of the poorest people in our city. This project opened a year ago, January. It's designed by Polshek Partners. It was kind of an engineering challenge, to say the least. We built it over three subway lines, so that the building is resting on about 190-foot piles and a system that cantilevers the building over the subway tubes. 60% of the units are occupied by individuals coming directly from the street, 40% by lower-income working people. The project is a partnership with the Actors Fund of America, who has taken the lead in the marketing largely to people working in the arts. The units are single-room studios with private baths, kitchenettes. The building is not LEED certified, but we like to say LEED inspired. Quite green. You see the marmoleum and this lovely channel glass that's recycled material, and that's kind of necessary to find a lightweight material for the facade because of the subway system. And so it has this beautiful luminescent quality. The building, as I mentioned, has 217 units. All of our tenants pay roughly 30% of their income toward rent. There are social services in the building to help people connect with health, mental health, and employment resources. And not surprisingly, people are successful tenants when you put that package together. And just to give you a sense of the rest of the lovely neighborhood, we have these 14 townhomes that sold out at what were, to that point, the highest prices obtained for single-family townhomes in Brooklyn. And we have this just amazing kind of statement about the kind of communities we can have in New York here with housing serving just the widest array of the housing market in terms of the different economic groups that are accommodated here, but yet a new neighborhood really bringing glue to this place that was a bit of a wasteland for many years. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Roseanne. And batting cleanup for us is Jonathan Rose, who in 1989 founded Jonathan Rose Companies, LLC, a multidisciplinary real estate development planning consulting and investment firm, as a leading green urban solutions provider. It now manages over $1.5 billion worth of work. So let's welcome Jonathan.
I would actually propose, by the way, that the definition of the panel is incorrect, and that the work that my colleagues and I are doing, which is really trying to integrate the social, environmental, and economic issues of the populations that really house our cities, is extremely conservative, and that what's radical is all the stuff that's being built that completely mismatches human and social need. So, this is just a quick film I made in 1984 of the South Bronx. And this is this happened all across America. We saw the hollowing out of our cities in a wide variety of ways. This is also in the Bronx. This is the Bronx River running through the Bronx. So the question really that came to us 20, 30 years ago and that RPA was asking was, how do we repair the fabric of our communities? And as devastating as that time was, it gave us a tremendous opportunity to reimagine our systems. So I think of cities as whole systems. I'm going to show you a lot of housing, but I'm actually going to start with a larger view. And one is that I totally agree with Geraldine that we must redensify our cities. The density is extraordinarily important. It's important to support the extraordinary infrastructure of schools, mass transit systems, data, all water, sewer, etc. And it actually, what happens is the higher the density, the metabolism of the city becomes more efficient, and that is why that people who live in New York City use 25% of the energy of people who live in suburban sprawl. But as we densify these cities, we also need to give people deeper contact with nature. And we have these great waterfronts and rivers that run through our cities. This is actually some work that we are doing in Newark. Our firm does a lot of planning work. We were just designated to do the Newark Master Plan, a green master plan. And where we're looking at as the kind of framework of the city, so this is the non-radical part, I actually believe, is to say that jobs really matter. I did some work for the Atlanta Beltline, a really wonderful plan to integrate a regional system around Atlanta, and our job was to look at some of the affordable housing issues, and what I realized was it wasn't a lack of affordable housing. It was a lack of jobs so that people could afford housing. And so to us, jobs and economic development are really a critical element of community revitalization. And then healthy and safe neighborhoods. It's not just about the buildings. In some ways, the buildings are the easy part. It's about the fabric of how those buildings fit together. And health, you know, LEED has done a great job. Enterprise New Communities, there are many ways we can now focus on making our buildings use less energy and even making our buildings be healthier. But they have to be part of a healthy neighborhood. And that is both, again, a physical infrastructure and a social infrastructure integration. And the last thing is choices. And one of the reasons we so deeply believe in walkable and transit-oriented communities is not only because those use so much less energy, but because they give working and poor people so many more choices. And I really believe that when you build very low-income housing in distant locations, you have not served that person, you have condemned that person. And that when you give them a neighborhood that is connected, and that means connected to lifelong education, it means connected to opportunity for their kids, It means connected to health opportunities, food opportunities, et cetera. When you actually give them choices and pathways, that is a foundational condition for human development. This happens to be in the Newark waterfront, where we've done work on the Passaic River. Again, as I said, if we're going to create great communities, then they need access to open space. We led a whole community-based planning process to figure out what should the revitalized waterfront be, and we're working on that with the Trust for Public Land. This is South Bronx Greenway. One more thing about community health. So here's some other work at Trust for Public Land. This is a schoolyard in Brooklyn, and that's the before, and that's the after. This is work we're doing on the Gowanus Canal. It's a project called Gowanus Green. It is actually very mixed income. It's in partnership with the Fifth Avenue community and several other private developers. But all of our work is in a partnership with not-for-profits. And as you can see, we're building denser buildings, Geraldine, which we absolutely need, but denser mixed-income, mixed-use buildings, but at the same time revitalizing green space. So we deeply believe in this nexus of denser and more open space at the same time. And that sounds like a conundrum. If you don't plan, it's a mix. It's unachievable. But if
Jonathan,
you plan...
Is that going forward with the Superfund?
We believe it is going forward with this. So the Superfund adds complexity to anybody who wants to do real estate along the canal. But we're very deeply committed to this project, and we will work in every way we can to keep moving it forward. We keep spending money and time on it. We're working very hard. We're very hard to keep it moving forward because it's a vision we really believe in. And by the way, we built for the long run, and so the long run, the canal will be cleaned up. And then it'll be great. I'm going to skip all this, because I know how short we are in time. I want to show you a body of work that we are doing. So the other thing is, as I said, community is not just about buildings. It's made of buildings. So I want to show you a body of work in the South Bronx and Harlem that we've been doing, so you can see different approaches. So this is on 135th Street. America, at best, builds 1% of its housing stock a year. So we have to deal with the 99% that exists. We will never green or improve or solve our problems only with new construction. This was a Section 8 project that was coming to the end of its Section 8 contract. An out-of-state owner owned it, offered it to the market to be gentrified. We have the country's first green real estate investment fund and our fund bought this project as an affordable housing preservation project. So we came in with the Enterprise Loan Fund, bought it to preserve it, extended the Section 8 contract for 20 years, and then became a pilot project under the Obama administration's new greening of Section 8 program and putting together financing, low-income housing tax credits, tax-exempt bonds, and money from the city and the feds are now greening these units, making them much healthier for the residents, lowering the energy costs, and keeping it as a long-term affordable housing project. Designed by Richard Dattner, architect sitting in the audience, this is David and Joyce Dinkins Gardens in Harlem, the first green affordable housing project in Harlem, built with HCCI, a wonderful collection of 90 churches and religious organizations working to improve their neighborhood. An example of integrated design, this is housing for youth aging out of foster care. About 40% of all kids in Harlem who turn 18, if they're in the foster care system, go homeless. This really goes, to Geraldine's point of who is a family and who are we designing for. And so this is a mixture of kids aging out of foster care and affordable housing units in the neighborhood. So how do we build really green buildings if you were going to compare this to LEED standard, and sometimes we do LEED certified, about LEED gold, without spending more? So, for example, we put the boiler on the roof. In New York, boilers were in basements because we used to shovel coal, and you want to shovel coal down, not up. Put a boiler on a roof because it's gas-fired. It runs 3% more efficient. When you put it on the roof, you save the flues going through the building. Flu is $10,000 a floor, so we save $90,000. We put that $90,000 into the sun shading, the exterior sun shading you see, which makes the building look better, but also reduces the energy costs, not for the owner, but for the residents. And lastly, when you eliminate the flu, you could gain a space about the size of a walk-in closet. So that is a green solution. There are many, many innovations in this building, but that's a green solution that lowers operating costs, lowers capital costs, and creates a higher net-to-gross ratio. So our whole green strategy is looking at integrated design, not additive design, to get there. The other thing we're really focusing now on is human behavior. So they're both the behavior of people who run buildings. BOMA has discovered that 25% of the America's buildings, if properly tuned, the 25% of the buildings that are in the bottom quarter, I got 1 minute left. So we will, anyway, human behavior, both of the operators and people living in the buildings, is, we think, one of the next frontiers. We're spending a lot of focus on how we create greener behaviors. This is the Fortune Society building. This is just about complete. Fortune provides amazing, designed by Mark Ginsburg, amazing social services for people coming out of the prison system. Again, mixture of homeless and people coming out of the prison system and local residents, also very green. This is the Tapestry. This is a 50-30-20. So you're seeing in all of these different income mixes, 50% market, 30% moderate, 20% low, designed by Herb Mandel and Harry Cobb of Paycob Freed, just going to market now. This is a proposal on a NYCHA site for another school on lower floors and affordable housing above and a park in front. We think that idea of integrating education, affordable housing, and public housing makes a tremendous amount of sense. One of the things to think about is, of public housing residents, they are not all the same, and that there is a great operator, move-up opportunity. You know, 40, 50, 60% of AMI actually can be a move-up opportunity in a public housing site. And lastly, David and Joyce Dinkins Gardens, also designed by Dattner and Grimshaw, going into, now actually in construction, but to have its ceremonial groundbreaking in a few weeks. And this is a view for really how to integrate many of these things. So we focus a lot on health. Ground floor has a Montefiore Hospital Health Center. The seventh floor actually has a health club. But most importantly, tall building in the north, and it steps down as we come to south. So a lot of sun penetration, a lot of very innovative unit, live-work units, different townhouses built into this, many different unit types for many different populations. But the roofs are all green. So in this case, we've actually brought nature. All the buildings, by the way, I've showed have green roofs. I just haven't had time to show that to you. But this is probably the best case. And this really focuses on growing food in the building, both in an orchard and community gardens, in reflective spaces with meditation spaces, in exercise spaces tied into the exercise. It's actually an amphitheater. So a heavy intent in modeling how we can integrate social health and environment in a very mixed income population. Great architecture, we think, is key to revitalizing neighborhoods. Thank you.
Thank you. Since we have so little time, I'm going to move immediately to questions from the audience. Who's got the mics? Hope's got one. So would you give your name and affiliation and the panelist of whom you're asking the question?
Yeah, my name is Mike Eustace. I work for IBM. I'm spending most of my time in architecture, green systems architecture for smarter cities, smarter buildings, on and on and on. I have noticed that the trend, of course, is to mixed occupancies with buildings, and I noticed that old ways of measuring your success in the various programs that you're running, either building the buildings or for homeless or whatever you're using them for, may not work in the future. I noticed that as I go around the countryside and in other countries, some agencies are having 100 to 300 key performance indicators for the success in their various developments. That's mind-boggling. It means that you must have 8 to 10,000 less important performance indicators. So my question is, if you were to boil it all down, how would you measure your success in your various programs? What are the 3 to 5 actual performance indicators that tell you whether you're being successful or not? Anyone on the panelists can answer.
Michael, do you mind handling that?
In in the ongoing operation or in the development activity? What are they, or both?
Actually, both. Right? You have to measure the fact that you've got the building, but the building itself can be reduced in numbers very easily. As soon as you call it housing, you add units, and then it becomes a little cloudier.
I'm more interested, though, not just in the building, but in the housing aspects ongoing.
Well, I think it's sort of embedded in probably Moseanne's presentation as much as mine, or probably more than mine, is one of the metrics needs to be family wealth. And looking at, are we creating not only buildings but neighborhoods of choice, as Jonathan said, and actually providing services within those developments that actually provide opportunities around job development and educational opportunities, et cetera. So I quickly moved to beyond just the energy efficiency of the building or you know the number of work orders that we were turning around or the you know the speed or under budget that a project that can be built at, and maybe you know, under the heading of radical housing, looking at a metric that goes beyond just shelter and what are we doing to provide the kind of physical amenities that build family infrastructure.
Could I add one thought, which is, you know, I wonder if it's the right unit of measure, sir, to be looking at just individual buildings. If we think of our cities as having housing systems, one really key indicator is it reaching everyone it needs to reach, the entire system?
And if you know, I think it also depends on what your goal is. But I think if we began to look at the housing market in New York as an actual whole market and not just in these pieces, public housing, subsidized, this, that, if we looked at it as a whole market, we would measure success by how long and whether a new entrant into the housing market can actually find housing that meets their needs, provides the right amount of space, gives them the housing bundle that goes with it that they're looking for and is affordable to them.
And I would just add, there's a lot of very interesting emerging work in what's called happiness and happiness indicators, real indicators of what much broader definitions of community wealth and individual happiness.
So, yes, back there.
My name is Michael Carroll, and I am the incoming president of the Park Slope Civic Council in Brooklyn. And there have been a lot of really interesting ideas and graphics presented today, but it seems that the most successful projects that you've presented all come from either singly or collectively the public sector, not-for-profits, not-for-profits. Particularly along a place, and I hate to pick on one street, but 4th Avenue in Brooklyn, that being sort of a metaphor for other places in the city, how do we provide incentives to the private sector, which is just building as of right, to engage in practices similar as these?
I'll start. I want to give credit to Hamlin Ventures and Time Equities in the case of the Skirmerhorn project, for instance, that I highlighted. The critical incentive there was an obligation under the urban renewal provision attached to the site. They interpreted that obligation in a really creative, pretty bold way in bringing us in as a partner, but that that obligation to have some affordability on the site was the important incentive that gave rise to the innovation.
And I guess I would say, you know, traditionally, the primary two tools for incentivizing the private sector is really our land use regulation, primarily our zoning resolution, and our tax laws, because we definitely in New York have a very robust system to provide tax exemptions for certain kinds of development and activity. Whether those tools are really creating the kind of housing or the kind of development that we would think is desirable is another question altogether. I mean, you look at our city prior to the 61 zoning resolution, and essentially it's a catalog of the kind of buildings that we all actually love today. So I'm not sure that the innovations on the zoning side have really resulted in buildings that we're going to love 50 years from now, or our children might love 50 years from now.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Amit Degani. I'm a graduate student at Hunter College. And we had, it's been talked about having education and public housing together. I was thinking more of, does it make sense, since we're trying to move toward removing the stigma of economic integration, to include topics like that within high school curriculums, to start talking about public housing and different types of housing and how it's acceptable in the urban environment to younger kids, this way they can grow up with these ideas being positive in their life.
Well, so, go ahead. You go for it.
My short answer is yes, but maybe not necessarily in the heading of housing as much as urban archaeology and urban sociology, and just showing the importance of people living together and different in the diversity, relishing the diversity, and getting that embedded in any kind of curriculum, I think is a great idea.
So one last question. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, wouldn't it be time to consider passive solar design at an urban scale now, in order to cut on cost and pollution? Because a LEED certification of individual building is fine, but it's not enough. And we can go much, much further by it. That's what we've been doing at Sustainable City Project, which I founded. We've been looking at comprehensive sustainable urban forms, which do combine the primary urban functions with jobs and services and commercial space and dwellings in the same city blocks, in order to maximize the affordability of the land use for affordability, and also combine this with the affordability and of the passive solar design, which would cut the need for energy by 70%.
Jonathan?
So every one of the projects I showed you was south-facing, had passive solar. The whole idea of using sunshades is part of that. They're all made out of block and plank. You use thermal mass. The Via Verde project in the South Bronx actually is a very long north-south site, and not only uses passive solar, but passive ventilation.
And if I could just add something, though, in a city like New York, you know, the two most important things that we could do to reduce our overusage of resources, environmental resources, it's not solar panels, it's not windmills on the roof, it's not bamboo floors, it's living in smaller spaces, and it's using mass transit. And if we did those things, we would really make our city better.
I think on that note, that's an extremely good closing sentence. Very RPA of you, Geraldyn. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. That's great, Geraldyn.